This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We see that Russia is using a series of asymmetric tactics like disinformation, election interference, undermining democracy, and sending mercenary groups, all with the aim of, you know, propping up various autocratic regimes that provide an entry point for Russian influence.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies on Russia's strategy in expanding its influence in Africa. Details coming up. Also, at least 118 inmates escaped when a long downpour damaged a medium security prison in Nigeria. And university campuses across the United States are seeing pro-Palestinian protests daily. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. U.S. and Niger officials are meeting today to discuss an orderly and responsible withdrawal of U.S. forces from the military-ruled country. The pullout follows similar actions by French forces in other Sahel nations where Russian paramilitary forces are expanding their influence. A State Department statement says the U.S. remains interested in ongoing collaboration in areas of joint interest despite the rift with Niger's military junta. We have on the phone Cindy Sain, who covers the State Department for VOA, to discuss the situation. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Cindy.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
What is the purpose of the meeting in Niamey today?
Right. Well, as you indicated, it is exactly about the withdrawal of the some 1,100 U.S. troops in Niger, and as you said, about a responsible and an orderly withdrawal over the next few months after Niger's military junta basically revoked its military cooperation deal with the United States. And the U.S. troops stationed there have basically been inactive since the military coup installed a military junta in Niger last July. And I was thinking back to, it was just last March that Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Niger and offered $150 million in U.S. humanitarian assistance and praised the country as an island of stability in the middle of a very insecure area.
How things change quickly. What does the withdrawal of U.S. troops mean for counterterrorism efforts and stability in West Africa?
Right. Yes, some U.S. officials have said that it is really a devastating blow to U.S. efforts. The U.S. has invested probably more than $1 billion in Niger over the past decades, building a base there and training forces there and building a new embassy in Niger, and with the point of training forces throughout the area. And as I said, Niger was sort of a bastion for counterterrorism efforts against ISIS and other Islamist militants in the area. And this is a big blow to those efforts, and some say also to efforts for peace and stability in the region.
And finally, Cindy, with the U.S. troops leaving Niger, what sort of a relationship does Washington expect to have with the government going forward?
Right. Washington is trying to maintain a relationship. It does plan to maintain diplomatic relations to keep that new embassy open. And as you indicated, some officials from Niger have also said they want to differentiate between the Americans and the French, and they are more interested in keeping a relationship with the Americans. But there have been some contentious discussions with the U.S. pointing out about the junta increasing ties with Russia and Iran, and that, I think, did not go over too well.
Cindy Sain, VOA State Department correspondent, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Since their military coup, Niger's new leaders have pursued closer ties with Russia, mirroring neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso, where Russian military forces have established a presence. According to Russian reports, the newly arrived personnel were part of Russia's Africa Corps, a paramilitary group established to replace the mercenary Wagner Group. U.S. military commanders have warned of the spread of Russian influence in the Sahel and in other parts of Africa at American expense. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed Russia's strategy with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
I think when we look at Russia's strategy in Africa, we have to recognize Russia's not investing in Africa. It's not a significant trade or development partner. Yet, since the invasion of Ukraine, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has made at least a dozen trips to the continent. And so, you know, the assessment is that Russia sees Africa as a geostrategic playground where it can demonstrate that Russia remains active and vital and welcome, even though Russia is isolated globally. And in the process, you know, Russia can continue to demonstrate that it's a great power and it remains uninhibited despite the sanctions and restrictions it's getting. And in terms of what Russia's trying to do in Africa, we see that Russia is using a series of asymmetric tactics, like disinformation, election interference, undermining democracy, and sending mercenary groups, all with the aim of, you know, propping up various autocratic regimes that provide an entry point for Russian influence.
U.S. military commanders have warned of the spread of Russian influence in the Sahel. American alarm rose when Niger's prime minister visited Moscow last December to discuss military and economic ties, followed by a visit by him to Tehran the following month, where he met Ibrahim Raisi, the Iranian president. What are the security implications for the region as a result of these developments?
I think, you know, we have to see that in every place that Russia has become more engaged in Africa, the situation has become more destabilized. And again, Russia's not investing financially, helping strengthen institutions or building capacity. So it is really, again, trying to gain influence by co-opting different autocratic governments. So the security implication will be destabilizing for the continent. I think Iran's engagements are still too early to say. You know, clearly we've seen in the Middle East that Iran will work through proxies to try to advance its interests. And so I think that's the concern that we would have and we want to watch in Africa, is that there aren't similar arrangements being created and to the detriment of African interest and African agency.
U.S. forces on the continent faced another blow last week when Chadian officials threatened to cancel the status of forces agreement, which determines the rules and conditions under which U.S. military personnel can operate in Chad. Officials said all U.S. forces would have to leave a French base in N'Djamena. What are the reasons for this shift in the position of the Déby regime?
I think a lot of this is posturing. Again, plays into geostrategic dynamic. The U.S. and Chad have had a long-standing military security agreement, and that has been seen as mutually of interest and beneficial. I think some of the dynamics that are shifting are both in the East, what's going on in Sudan, and in N'Djamena itself. So in the East, Russians have been supporters of the rapid support forces, and they are supporting the RSF through both their bases in Central African Republic and in Eastern Libya. And the UAE is also linked with providing support to RSF from forward operating in Eastern Chad. And I believe that we've seen is growing pressure from Moscow on the Déby regime to support those efforts. So we've seen recent exchanges between the Déby regime and Moscow. And this may just be a decision on part of the Déby regime that it's better to work with Russia and have shared interest in supporting RSF at the, rather than trying to resist that and threaten destabilizing and be faced with destabilizing actions on the part of Moscow. I think the political dynamics are that Déby is vying for elections on May 6th, and this is widely seen as an orchestrated effort. The opposition hasn't had much space to compete. This follows Mohamed Déby's coup following the death of his father after Mohamed Deby had indicated that there would be a democratic transition, that he would not stand for president. And so the posturing, I think, vis-a-vis Russia is a way for the regime of Mohamed Deby to hedge their bets and try and restrict the amount of criticism that they'll receive for the conduct of this election.
That was Joseph Siegel at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. University campuses across the United States are seeing pro-Palestinian protests daily. Students are demonstrating against the Israeli and Hamas war in Gaza and demanding that humanitarian aid be allowed to flow into the territory. Although some students and demonstrators have been arrested or suspended, it appears the protests are not dying down. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the story.
Pro-Palestinian students protest at Columbia University in New York, even as administrators call for the dismantling of encampments. Negotiations on how to disperse the crowd are underway. Last Thursday, more than 100 students were arrested at universities across the country. The protests come at a time when school administrators are being urged to clamp down on anti-Semitism. VOA witnessed firsthand the aftermath of Thursday's arrests at Columbia University. One protester who declined to give her name laid out some of the students' demands.
I'm here to demand immediate ceasefire along with my other comrades so we can get humanitarian aid to Gaza.
Architecture professor Mary McLeod expressed her views on measures being taken to handle the demonstrations.
I don't know why they had to bring in the cops, put handcuffs on students, and why they can't accept a few tents where the students were totally peaceful.
A Columbia student who identified herself as Argentinian Jewish saw it differently.
It's very scary. I can't concentrate during the class because they're screaming all day. I'm scared to say that I'm Jewish because I don't know their extremists. They were holding pictures and supporting Hamas.
Protests have continued to spread to other campuses in the United States. On Tuesday, a tent camp was erected at the University of California, Berkeley, in a show of support for those arrested at Columbia and Yale universities on Monday. In the nation's capital, students at the American University protested internal policies they say resulted from the pro-Palestinian demonstrations nationwide, and already curtailed their freedom of expression.
It's a new policy, a new directive, which banned indoor protest, which AU has a long history of having indoor protests. It also restricted flyering and what type of materials can be posted around campus and who can do it.
In a statement to VOA, the American University said the directives were implemented to support the safety and sense of belonging for students, and that it will continue to support the rights and responsibilities of free expression.
Politicians have also weighed in.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson called for the resignation of the president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq, during a visit to the campus on Wednesday. On Tuesday, House Minority Leader Democrat Hakeem Jeffries condemned all forms of anti-Semitism and called for a redoubling of efforts to bring communities together. After giving remarks on Earth Day on Monday, President Joe Biden told reporters he condemns anti-Semitic protests and, quote, those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. One expert on religion and conflict says academic institutions need places where students can have meaningful discussions.
One needs to be very careful about talking about sides and recognize that there are some issues about justice that bring together Jewish, Muslim, Palestinians, Christian students to that space of protest. And indeed, the issue is that there is a deep confusion and what exactly, how to define anti-Semitism.
Meanwhile, the death toll in Gaza has surpassed more than 34,000, according to Gaza's health ministry.
and there's no sign the war between Israel and Hamas is going to end anytime soon. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The Nigerian Prison Service says at least 118 inmates escaped last night when a lengthy heavy downpour wrecked parts of a medium security prison in Suleja near the capital, including the perimeter wall and surrounding buildings. Reuters news agency security service agents were hunting the fugitives and had so far recaptured at least 10. A prison spokesperson asked the public to watch for the fleeing inmates. No details have been given on the identities or affiliation of the escaped prisoners, but in the past, members of the Boko Haram Islamist insurgent group have been locked up in Suleja prison. U.S. President Joe Biden is making reproductive rights a centerpiece of his re-election campaign, blaming his opponent Donald Trump for opening the way to stricter state abortion laws. In this presidential campaign, Trump is pursuing a more moderate position on abortion than some in his Republican Party prefer. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Joe Biden campaigned on reproductive rights in Florida, where a state ban on abortion beyond 6 weeks becomes law next week.
It's criminalizing reproductive health care before women even know whether they're pregnant. I mean, this is bizarre.
The Florida abortion law will be one of the nation's most restrictive and is a victory for the state's conservative Republican leaders, says University of Miami law professor Caroline Mala Corbin.
For those of people whose religion teaches that life begins at conception, and therefore pregnancy is the moral equivalent of a human being, this decision is obviously triumph.
It's also a political challenge for Donald Trump, who says the Florida law goes too far, but who also wants to remind anti-abortion voters that he ended federal abortion protections with Supreme Court appointments that shifted the judicial majority on the court and overturned Roe v. Wade. The Biden campaign sees that as a political opportunity.
For 50 years, the court ruled that there was a fundamental constitutional right to privacy. But 2 years ago, that was taken away. Let's be real clear. There's one person responsible for this nightmare, and he's acknowledged and he brags about it, Donald Trump.
Trump does brag about it and did so again in a video on his social media site this month.
This 50-year battle over Roe v. Wade took it out of the federal hands and brought it into the hearts, minds, and vote of the people in each state. It was really something. Now it's up to the states to do the right thing.
The challenge is when states do things with which Trump does not agree, like Florida and like Arizona, where the state Supreme Court upheld an 1800s ban on nearly all abortions. Voters in Arizona and Florida will both have abortion rights measures on their November ballots. Similar initiatives in Kansas and Ohio over the last 2 years have been losing propositions for Republicans. And Trump is reminding supporters about the electoral vulnerability of abortion.
Like Ronald Reagan, I am strongly in favor of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture and, in fact, to save our country, which is currently and very sadly a nation in decline.
It's a vulnerability Biden is pressing.
Donald Trump is worried voters are going to hold him accountable for the cruelty and chaos he created. Folks, the bad news for Trump is we are going to hold him accountable. We are. He should be held accountable.
As part of its push on reproductive rights, the Biden administration this week strengthened medical records privacy for people traveling across state lines. It's aimed at protecting women who live in states where abortion is illegal from being prosecuted in that state for having an abortion elsewhere. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
A gold mine in Zimbabwe has turned its former dump site into a solar station, generating all the energy it needs for operations at the mine and releasing excess energy into the national grid. Located in Zimbabwe's southwestern Bubi district, some 500 kilometers from the capital, the project has drawn praise from environmentalists. Columbus Mavunga has more.
After losing hours and hours of production due to Zimbabwe's chronic power shortages, the Tech Gold Mine decided to take action. Workers removed 1.5 million tons of mining waste from a dump site and erected a solar power station that generates 4.4 megawatts of electricity per hour. Taurai Danda is the mine's environmental manager.
The installation of that plant on a former dam site was a strategic plan to say we have to save the environment, we have to avoid cutting into new virgin land. So we opted for a former dam site, which we had rehabilitated. Since then, the generation from the solar plant is able to run the plant, every equipment, every asset that we have on the mine, and with excess, that power is thrown into the national grid.
Danda says the new dam site, unlike the previous one, does not release contaminated waste into a nearby river. Instead, the solid waste is kept in the dam site while water is recycled for use at the mine. Chipompo Fuzuze, who heads the Environmental Management Agency in this southwest region of Zimbabwe, says other mines should emulate the Tech mine, which despite its name is owned primarily by Canadians.
They removed waste, the tailings, to a new site which is properly engineered to protect underground water contamination. And what we also appreciate is they didn't open a new virgin land to site their solar field. They've also saved the forest. What we also appreciate again is they've gone green. Instead of relying on thermal power or hydropower, we know the impact on the environment.
Tech mine and government scientists say the solar project spread across 3.6 hectares of land will save 5.4 million kilograms per year in coal for thermal energy, or 116.8 million liters of water for hydropower. It's not only environmental scientists welcoming the project. 23-year-old Precious Piri, a mother of one, is one of the locals employed to clear the solar panels of dust from a nearby road and lime mining operation. Piri says, "My life has changed financially. I'm now able to pay for my children's fees, buy uniforms, and I'm able to do whatever he wants in life. As a mother, I'm able to do these things." Zimbabwe's power utility says that with the global calls for green energy to reduce emissions, the Tech Mine solar project is commendable, especially in Zimbabwe, where energy shortages are worsening due to droughts in the region. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Bubi, Zimbabwe.
Britain's King Charles has given his assent to legislation central to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to send illegal asylum seekers to Rwanda. Royal assent is the final stage in the legislative process. It effectively rubber stamps the decision taken by Parliament earlier this week to approve the bill after a long battle. Reuters News reports that the royal assent was announced in the House of Lords today, meaning the safety of the Rwanda bill will now become law. Parliament approved the legislation in the early hours of Tuesday morning. On Monday, Sunak said he expected the first flights to Rwanda to take off in 10 to 12 weeks. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.